Amen. You guys can take a seat. My name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors at Revision. I'm excited to be here this morning. How about you? That was pretty bad. We're going again. I'm excited to be here. How about you? That's better. So a couple winters ago, my wife decided completely arbitrarily, but very firmly, that we were going to start setting our thermostat 2 degrees cooler than we used to. And I have been cold ever since. So to make up for the fact that Jenny apparently loves living in an igloo, I like to keep it real warm at the Revision office, which has worked out well for me because Courtney's always cold. Also, Jeff has -3% body fat, and Jeremy's too new to complain. But whenever anyone else comes to the office to work or shoot videos, they always comment about how hot it is. And so we've learned if other people are going to be there, we got to turn the thermostat down, especially if it's going to be a group of people for a board meeting, house group leaders meeting, youth leadership team meeting. More bodies tend to raise the temperature. That's just science, right? But one thing I've learned over a lot of years in leadership is that that doesn't happen equally. It's not like an equation you could plug in, like for every 10 people, we're going to lower it half a degree given the square footage. No, some people bring more heat. You ever been in a room that's just dead and feels apathetic and somebody walks in who's excited and living life to the fullest and they just raise the temperature? Or some of us know what it is to sit in meetings where people are just confirming each other's cynicism. And the mood is negative, and then one jerk sneaks in a little bit of hope and vision, and it changes the whole flavor. Some people bring more heat than others. And there's something compelling about those people. The Bible's actually full of stories about people like that. But one thing I realize every time I read it is that all of those great moments, the most memorable stories, come in the context of the worst moments. Since I was a little kid, every time I've heard somebody say, oh, I want to be like the heroes in the Bible, I've always thought, I'm not sure you've read the Bible. Like, ooh, I want a life like her. You really don't. Trust me. Have you read about her life? And I think what we're saying is we want the great moments in the Bible. We just don't want the kind of lives that made them happen. We don't want to have to live out the circumstances and the stories that laid the groundwork for those great moments. A whole lot of the people in the Bible we admire were slaves. It's not on any of our wish list. They were overwhelmingly oppressed. In America, we like to pretend we're oppressed every time our favorite candidate loses or someone dares to disagree with us, but we have no context for how they actually lived. We're just jealous of the great moments in their stories. And I'm convinced what we want is for God to do extraordinary things in our lives without ever putting us in situations that are anything other than ordinary, without ever causing us to suffer stuff we don't like. We just pray, God, do something big. Have you ever prayed that? Ever ask God, like, oh, God, please just work in and through me to make a difference. And then God completely misinterprets you, and you suddenly find yourself facing a crisis, and you're like, God, no, what? You idiot, this is not, why? Like, we all want God to make us giant killers, just as long as we don't ever have to see any giants. It's easy to be courageous in situations where no courage is required. It's easy to claim faith in situations where no faith is required. It's easy to be a leader in situations where no leadership is required. It's really easy to spend our lives chasing the path of least resistance, avoiding any and all conflict that might lay out ahead of us, and then wonder why we feel stuck and God is not showing up big. But I'm convinced that if we really want God to do incredible things, if we want him to work in and through our stories to change the world, then sometimes we have to walk through the wilderness. Sometimes we have to leave the place where we are and exist for a while in the place that isn't yet where we want to be, because the wilderness is fertile ground for God to do his best work. It's a space where he works transformation and impact. But it's a difficult space. It's easy to feel like we're in the wilderness and we're running out of hope and we're losing, but we can win in the wilderness. This morning we're in week 6 of this series called Winning in the Wilderness, where we've been walking through the life of Daniel, taking a look at how he was able to thrive rather than just survive, and getting a bigger, better picture of who God made all of us to be so that we too can make an impact even in difficult seasons. And this morning we're going to take a look at probably the most famous story in the entire book of Daniel. It's Daniel in the lion's den, Daniel chapter 6. So if you have a Bible or a Bible handy, you can crack it open to Daniel 6. If you don't, no worries, you can follow along on the screen or in the Revision app. And if you need a Bible, please take one from the Next Steps table before you go today. If you're watching online, let us know on your digital connection card and we will mail one to you. They're free. But Daniel 6 really is one of those great moments in the Bible. And it really is one of those moments that happens in the context of an awful moment that feels like it's the end of Daniel's story. I can still remember learning about this chapter on a flannel graph in Sunday school as a kid. Everyone under 30 is looking at me like I just made up a word. Flannel graph? Well, what it was a board covered in blue felt, and you cut out Bible characters and stuck them on there to tell the story. That's how far church technology had advanced by the 1980s. It was just as good as videos. It's amazing any of us stayed awake for that stuff. But anyways, I learned about it on the flannel graph, and right after that, we sang a song called Be a Daniel, about how we're supposed to be like Daniel. And that's the first time I remember thinking somebody didn't read the story, because I'm looking at my teacher like, did you listen to the story you just told? I listened to the story. I watched you put flannel lions right next to flannel Daniel's flannel face, and I don't think I want to be a Daniel. It sounds scary, and I'm not that brave. And maybe some of you are sitting here this morning feeling a whole lot like kid Mike felt. Not that brave. You know you're in the wilderness. You're looking at all the challenges the last year has brought to your life, and something inside of you says, I do not have the courage to win. I don't have the courage to keep going forward and beat back this darkness that's closing in on me. And if that's you, if you feel like, man, I know it takes courage to win in the wilderness, and it does, a whole lot of it, but I just don't have enough this morning, good news. Daniel 6 is not a story for people that were born brave. It's a story about how all of us can find the kind of courage it takes to make a difference, even when life is hard. This is what it says. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them, so the king might not suffer loss. Now, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, we will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God. Real quick time out. Daniel's in his 80s at this point. He's an old guy, and he is still so powerful, still so brilliant, still so influential that the king is like, I got to put this guy in charge of everything. And it's interesting that we hear that he was neither corrupt nor negligent, because the environment that he's working in is one that's full of bribes and kickbacks and under-the-table deals. That's how you got ahead in government in Babylon. That's how all things moved in the political realm. It was way different than it is today. But anyway, somehow, Daniel is able to make a difference without doing any of that stuff. In verse 3, we read that he has these exceptional qualities, and that literally translates a spirit of excellence. What that tells us is that Daniel's living with deep integrity in every space he occupies, every moment of his life, which is why he keeps getting promoted, which is what makes everybody around him jealous, because they want to get promoted instead. And so they're looking for a way to bring him down, but they realize he's so good and so honest. We're going to have to lie and be bad if we want to take him out. And so these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, may King Darius live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days except you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Like, the Persians believed that their rulers were deities. It's like, anybody who prays to you, let's get rid of them. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before. I love Daniel's response. He hears that this new law has been passed, that if he keeps praying like he prayed before, if he keeps living with integrity before God like he lived before, they're going to kill him. And he could have taken the path of least resistance. He could have just not prayed for a month, right? He wouldn't have been the first follower of God in the history of the world to spend a month not really carving out time for prayer. Like, I'm sure no one in this room has done it, but other people, worse Christians than us, people that go to different churches, I've heard it happens. He could have done that. Most of us would have done that. Or he could have gone inside his house and prayed in a closet where nobody would catch him praying. But not Daniel. Now he walks straight to the window where he always prays, hits his knees, and gives thanks to God just like he always has in defiance of the emperor. And make no mistake, this is public and purposeful defiance. He knows exactly what's going on. He knows exactly what the consequences are going to be, but he does it anyway because he knows who he is. Daniel's able to live with this incredible, world-changing courage because he knows exactly who he is, and for him that matters more than what he does. He's in this spot where he's about to be promoted to being like the second highest ruler in the entire kingdom, and he's well aware that his prayer routine will cost him that gig. It'll cost him his job, cost him his influence, and probably cost him his life. But abandoning that prayer routine will cost him his identity. And one of those things matters way more to Daniel than the others. I think one of the biggest mistakes we make, and so many people in our culture make, is deciding what we want to do before we decide who we want to be. It's always a mistake to decide what you want to do before you decide who you want to be, because who you are will determine how you do what you do. And in this world, in your life, in your work, in your schooling, in your relationships, you're always going to be given the opportunity to compromise, to reach out and snatch what you want for yourself by selling your integrity down the river and taking ethical shortcuts. You're always going to be invited to just blend in and assimilate, just like Babylon invited Daniel to blend in and assimilate. And if you do not know who you are, then one of two things is going to happen. Either you'll become so rigid that you're unable to change the things about you that have to be transformed in order for you to be all that God made you to be, or you'll become so fluid that you're unable not to change the things that cannot change, or you'll lose yourself along the way. Daniel's able to live with courage and integrity because he knows exactly who he is. And we got to figure that out too. The question we need to ask is not what do I want to do in this life, but who am I going to be in this life? Because who you are sets the parameters for what you do and how you do it. And if we get it right, then we can make the impact God placed us here to make, just like Daniel did. Daniel goes straight to the window to pray because he knows who he is. He is Daniel. His name's actually three syllables in Hebrew. Dan means judge. E means my, and El means God. Daniel means God is my judge. And that guy lives every second of his life like that's true. Like what God thinks of us matters infinitely more than what everybody else thinks of us. I know there are a lot of people sitting in this room who would say we believe that. Like, oh yeah, that's true. What God thinks matters more than what everyone else thinks. But if you press pause and you look at our lives and the way we spend our time, there's a whole lot more of it spent courting the opinions of other people than there is seeking out the heart of God through prayer and reading the Bible, which makes me wonder if we actually believe that as much as we say we do, as much as Daniel did. And we should. We ought to aim our lives in that direction because God's opinion is the one that matters. And if you spend your life, if you waste your life trying to please everybody around you, you will fail. If you don't believe that's a fact, I promise you it is. Try leading a church through a pandemic. You will find all kinds of displeased people. Like if you try to please everybody else, you'll fail. If you try to please God, you'll prosper. That's Daniel's story, and that's why he does what he does. And it's incredible to me, because I'll be real with you guys. I'm not proud of this, but if I'm raw and honest, I don't know that I would have had the courage to walk to the window and pray if I thought that I'd be thrown in a den of hungry lions for doing it. Think about that. That's about the most horrifying, awful, scary thing I can picture. I watched Tiger King, you guys. I watched the whole thing. That one kid lost an arm just for putting an arm in the cage. That arm was gone, man. And then you put my whole body in there? No, I want to live. But here's the deal. Here's what I think the big idea of Daniel is, what his story is teaching us. Private character fuels public courage. Private character fuels public courage. Daniel's able to live with this boldness that defies an empire because he had already pre-decided who he was going to be. He knows who he is. So he does what he does in a way that confused everybody around him. Like, can you imagine being one of those guys who was trying to trap him? Like, you go check on him, you're like, I wonder if Daniel's going to change. And then he's praying in his window. You got to be like, I can't believe he's actually doing it. I mean, I thought he would do it. It's consistent with this character. This is what we were hoping that he would do. But I can't believe that idiot is actually doing it. Now we're going to kill him. We're going to throw him straight to the lions. And if you zoom out, their hostility seems a little bit weird, doesn't it? Like, he is such a nice, good guy. We should feed him to hungry beasts. It doesn't make sense. Except that it does. They don't understand him. And human beings are afraid of things we don't understand. And it's true for you and me as well. If we dedicate our lives to God, if we chase after Jesus with absolutely everything we have, we're always going to be weird to the world. In a world full of compromise, people who live with integrity are strange. It's this simple. The world has never quite understood Christians. So we should probably stop getting so bent out of shape about that on Facebook. Like, I cannot believe what the world is doing to the church. I can't believe they're rejecting us. It's been over 2,000 years, you guys. At some point, we got to stop being shocked. It just is. It is. Like, to a watching world, the way we live and the one we live for is inexplicable. In a way that creates angst among people, even if they like us. Even if they're grateful for the way that we live and they're thankful for the ways in which God's people bring flourishing to everyone around them, there's this tension there. And the best way that I can think of to illustrate it comes from a pretty nerdy source. It's the Lord of the Rings. But in that story, there are these four insignificant, tiny, nothing little creatures called hobbits. Frodo, Sam, Merry, and Pippin. And they live in this quiet, simple place called the Shire. And they love their small, laid-back land and their calm way of life. But at one point, the four of them get caught up in this great adventure that forces them to leave the Shire. And they see things they've never seen before. They see beautiful things and incredible things. They find camaraderie and witness self-sacrifice that they've never seen. They see lands and meet people that are completely unlike the land they came from and the people they've always known. And they see horrible things too, awful things. They witness war and destruction and death. They see darkness and evil like they never could have imagined before, but they continue to press forward because they know that if they don't win, that if they don't complete the mission, along with everything and everyone else, the Shire will be lost. And at the end of the day, they complete the task that's been given to them, and then they return home to this land that they love, the one that they saved. And something paradoxical happens. Because of their incredible experiences, they become leaders in the Shire. They're able to step up and help the people around them in ways that they never could before. Things that shake the other hobbits, don't shake them anymore. And so they're able to bring extra flourishing to everyone around them. And the rest of the hobbits are incredibly grateful for their leadership and their self-sacrifice, but also they don't understand them like they used to. They're weird. Like, why do they laugh so loud? They never used to laugh like that. Why do they weep so deeply and so frequently? They never used to cry like that. Why do they sing weird songs to tunes the rest of us can't hear? They never used to sing like that. Why do they live with such radical self-sacrifice? They never used to give like that. Why do they love so passionately? They never used to be that self-sacrificial. They never used to be like that. They're weird. They've changed. And the reason is simple. They've seen a world that exists beyond the myopia of their culture. They realized they were part of a bigger story. They'd been transformed by something so much larger than themselves that the roots of their souls were no longer planted in the Shire. The very thing that made them more effective in the Shire and better for the Shire also alienated them from the Shire, because they were now citizens of a different country. The Shire was their home. It was the place where they lived, but their souls were anchored in a world beyond the one they were living in. They were more effective in the place that they lived, but also weird inside of it because they didn't belong to it anymore. They were able to bless it without belonging to it. And that's Daniel's story in Babylon. He was more effective in Babylon, but also weird inside of it because he was a citizen of a different kingdom. You guys, that's the story of the last two millennia. The church. We laugh louder and cry harder and love deeper and sacrifice more for the sake of the world around us. We give everything we've got to bring flourishing to every human we crash into. And you look at the legacy: hospitals, schools, women as people rather than property, children as people rather than property, art and science, and community across socioeconomic lines, the idea that every single human being on this planet ought to be treated with equal dignity, no matter what color their skin is. Almost every significant innovation that has brought about human flourishing for the last two millennia has been a gift to the world from the people of God. These resident aliens who make the world a better place because we don't belong to it, because we've tasted and seen a greater one, and that's where our citizenship lies. And our world has responded to that with gratitude, with curiosity, and with angry persecution, because they don't understand it, just like Jesus promised they would. So if the world hates you, keep in mind it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. But as it is, you do not belong to the world, for I've chosen you out of the world. Remember, no servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. Ask what Daniel's living. He's spending himself for the sake of a world that wants to get rid of him because it doesn't understand why he's living, how he's living, but he doesn't care. He doesn't care because he knows who he is and whose he is. And he walks to the window and prays, and these guys catch him doing it, which was the whole point of passing the law. They're just waiting outside his window to catch him. And they catch him, and then they go to the king, and they're like, all right, remember you made that law? The king's like, yeah, I made that law. Like, remember that the law can't be repealed in our country? He's like, yeah, I know. Like, Daniel broke it. We know he's your boy, and you're going to want to save him. But tough luck. He got to be fed to the lions. And in verse 16, this is what we read. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him in the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. And a stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without entertainment. Poor guy. No Netflix. And he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? And Daniel answered, may the king live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done anything wrong before you, your majesty. The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. It's no wonder this is one of the most famous stories in the Bible. Like, seriously, how cool is this? A guy gets thrown into a cave with a whole bunch of hungry lions, and these lions were beaten and starved so that they would eat people immediately, and nothing happens to him. I cannot even wrap my mind around what that experience might have been like for Daniel. I'm sure as he was getting shoved into the den, he thought, well, this is the end of the story. But I'm also sure he was the least surprised person in the entire empire when it wasn't. When somebody showed up and he wasn't alone in there anymore. Because God shut the mouths of the lions. And I like to imagine that when Daniel looked up and realized he wasn't alone and the mouths of the lions were shut, he was so at peace and so excited that he went on some lion rides. I like to think he was like, all right, I'm going to ride these bad boys around. And he took some laps and then he slept like a baby. maybe on a pile of lions. Maybe he's the only human in the history of the world to sleep on a lion pile. I don't even think that's a ridiculous thing to imagine. Here's why. Character fuels courage. We said that, right? Character fuels courage. But the thing Daniel's life is actually built on, the thing this story revolves around, isn't even Daniel's character as much as it is God's character. Like, this is a story about how awesome God is, more than it's a story about how awesome Daniel is. It's God's character that fuels our courage. Daniel knows who he is because he knows whose he is. He knows who made him. And because of his confidence that God shows up and that God is the author of the story, he's able to live with incredible courage. God's character fuels our courage. But I think if we're going to leave today and let God's character fuel our courage in a way that allows us to walk out and raise the temperature of the rooms that we're in, there are a couple things in this story we got to make sure we don't get twisted. And they're easy things to twist, and I sadly think the church has sometimes twisted them. I know the two things that I misunderstood as a kid looking at that flannel graph. And the first one is this. Too often when we tell this story, we focus on Daniel's courage inside the lion's den. We say, oh, Daniel bravely faced the lions. But by the time he got thrown in there, it didn't matter. That's God's thing. He was in his 80s. He could have been the bravest guy in the world or the scaredest guy in the world. He was either getting eaten or God was shutting the lion's mouth. It doesn't matter what sort of courage he had inside the lion's den. That's not the point of the story, at all. The point of the story is the courage he lived with that got him thrown in there in the first place. There are 150 verses about the life of Daniel in Babylon before he got thrown in the lion's den, and zero about his experience inside of it. Not one word about what that night was like, other than Daniel in the morning saying, hey, God shut their mouths, I'm still alive. And what I want us to see is that it's just as big of a miracle that his enemies couldn't find one single thing with which to accuse him, as it is that he didn't get eaten by lions. See, real courage isn't displayed through occasional actions in the face of impossible odds. It's displayed through daily faithfulness in the face of a wilderness world. And sadly, I think most people will never get the chance to experience one of those great God moments where he shows up and shows off, because they aren't living the kind of lives that create space for those moments to happen. And the second thing we got to understand is this, and it's a big one. The point of the story is not if you're good, God will always keep you safe. Like, if you just trust in God, you don't have to be afraid of anything, because God will never let you get a scratch on you. I think too often in some different ways that message gets communicated, and it hurts my heart, because like, no wonder you bailed on church if you got taught that. Because the first time you got scratched, the first time you walked away with bumps and bruises, you'd be like, I tried to be faithful and look at me. It's not like Daniel. But that's not the point of this story at all. Not even a little bit. You guys, I know someone who trusted God a whole lot more than Daniel did. He got thrown in a den and they rolled a stone over the front of that too. But he came out with nail holes in his hands and his feet with a whole lot of scratches. And that's the gospel. That's God stepping in to be with us, to suffer with us, to suffer for us, to accomplish something for us that we couldn't do for ourselves, to create space for reconciliation, to set the world right again. And that's the big idea of Daniel 6. That's what God's trying to get us to see. When he shuts the mouths of the lions, he's actually aiming us forward to this great thing he's been doing, that he is doing, that he's been doing since the very beginning, since Genesis 3, that he's setting the world right again. That's what he wants us to see here. It's interesting. All the miracles that we see in the Bible, all of them, follow the same sort of pattern. Not one is just a naked display of power. We never see Jesus or his disciples look at people and be like, you see that volcano? I'm going to make it erupt. See that mountain? I'm going to make it crumble to the sea. I mean, that kind of stuff might have been more convincing to all the skeptics. But instead, they just walk around feeding hungry people, making blind people see, making crippled people walk, healing the sick. Why? Because all of that stuff is not a suspension of the natural order of things. It's a restoration of the natural order of things. See, every time God acts miraculously in the Bible, what he's doing is pointing us back to the way the world was meant to be. He's opening our eyes to the things he's doing even now to make it that way again. So Daniel in the lion's den, it's a picture. It's a picture of this beautiful prophetic vision Isaiah had written down a couple hundred years earlier. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together. And a little child will lead them. It's a picture of the world as it could be, should be, will be. All throughout the Old Testament, the imagery of roaring lions is meant to convey the disharmony of nature in this broken world. And so Daniel 6 is meant to convey the way God puts all of that back together. What he's doing to set things right by stepping in. Like, I believe that the angel that showed up in the den with Daniel is the exact same one that showed up in the furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel 3. It's Jesus. It's Jesus stepping in to suffering. Again, always, every time. And I don't know why he waited till Daniel was in the den. I don't know why he waited till Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were in the furnace. I believe with every bit of who I am that he could have saved them earlier. But it appears that Jesus doesn't deliver outside the den. He doesn't deliver outside the fire, but he never abandons us to it. Which means no matter what circumstances you're staring down right now, no matter what wilderness we find ourselves existing in, we can know there is another in the fire standing next to me. We can walk out into a world that's full of scary lions and let them roar, because the only ones that can actually harm us, the ones that can kill our souls, Jesus already faced for us. So what do we have to be afraid of? Why shouldn't we live bold? Because the world's a frightening place, we don't have to be frightened anymore. I love the way C.S. Lewis put it. He said, "You will never tame the lions in your life unless you let God be the untamed lion in your life." What he's saying is, until you're in awe of God, until you surrender yourself completely to him, you say, "I'm going to do what you want me to do, and I'm going to be who you made me to be, because I'm so overwhelmed by who you are and what you accomplished for me." Until that's where your citizenship is found, until that's where your identity is rooted, until that's what your life is built upon, you're going to be afraid of all kinds of things. Because this shattered world has no shortage of stuff to haunt you. But once you know who he is, what he's done, and who he says you are, your character can fuel a public courage in you that allows you to walk out into a wilderness world and make a difference. A courage that allows you to say, "I'm going to live boldly without caring about what anyone else thinks, because Daniel, God is my judge." A courage that allows you to face the challenges in front of you rather than run away from them, in a way where God can show up and show off and do great things in and through your life that rewrite the story and create a better future for the people around you. A way that allows you to walk in and raise the temperature of the room. That's the kind of courage Daniel had. That's the kind of courage God wants to give every single one of us. And that's the courage we can have. That's who we can be when we know who God is, what God's done for us, and who he says we were made to be. Will you guys pray with me? God, thank you. Thank you for never abandoning us to the fire, never just leaving us in the den. Thank you for being a God whose character and whose faithfulness and whose love allows us to live courageously in a very scary world. Thank you for being that untamed lion who is so big, so great, but also so in control of the story that we don't have to worry about all the other lions in our world. God, would you just fill us this morning with a deep sense of who you are and how you love? Would you fill us with awe and wonder at what you've done for us, and would you remind us who you called us to be so that we can go live with integrity in a world full of compromise? We can go live with courage in a scared world in a way that changes the story, that raises the temperature for everybody around us and points them toward you. We pray this in Jesus' name.